Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Workforce and Business Development Finance and Policy Committee. I call this meeting to order. This remote hearing is being conducted pursuant to Rule 10.01. This remote hearing can be viewed on the House webcast. And with that, I would like to ask the Committee Legislative Assistant to now take the role.
Chair Noor.
Present.
Chair Noor, present. Vice Chair Jay Xiong. Vice Chair Jay Xiong is excused.
He's excused. Okay.
Lead Hamilton.
Present.
Lead Hamilton, present. Baker. Baker. Dabney.
Present.
Dabney, present. Frankie,
present.
Frankie, present. Greenman.
Present.
Greenman, present. Haley. Jurgens.
Jurgens, present.
Jurgens, present. Cagle.
Present.
Cagle, present. Katiza Watun.
Present.
Katiza Watun, present. Olson.
Present.
Olson, present. Tujong. Baker. Haley. Tujong. Mr. Chair, we have quorum.
Members, there's a quorum present. With that, I will entertain a motion to approve the minutes for March 22nd.
So move, Mr. Chair.
Representative Olson moves the approval for the minutes for March 22nd, 2021. Any discussions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Seeing none, the motion is approved and the minutes are now adopted for March 22nd, 2021. With that, members, we do have one important bill before us today, and we will allow members to have time, but I just wanted to make sure that as normal, a process that we have in this committee, we allow the testifiers and also the bill author to present the bill. With that, I'd like to welcome Chair Richardson to present to us House File 1200. I will move that House File 1200 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Welcome to the committee. Please tell us about your bill and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have an A2 amendment that would get the bill in the shape that I would like.
All right. So I will move the A2 amendment. Members, if you can explain a little bit, Chair Richardson, the A2 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, the A2 amendment aligns the timelines within the bill. It clarifies that benefits and the benefit account related sections are effective January 1st, 2024. The premium related sections are effective January 1st, 2023, and that the general provisions are effective July 1st, 2021.
Members, if there are no any discussions, all those in favor of approval for A2 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? See none, the amendment is adopted. Chair Richardson, to your bill as amended. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1200 would create a statewide paid family and medical leave insurance benefit program. The program is modeled after our state's unemployment insurance benefit program and would provide a much needed safety net for families. At some point, the majority of workers will need to take some time away from work to care for a new child, a family member that is sick, or to recover themselves from illness. Caring for others and receiving care is a key component of being human and living a fulfilling life. Unfortunately, the reality for the majority of Minnesotans is not that simple. Only about 13% of the Minnesota workforce has paid family leave through an employer, and an estimated 44% have access through an employer-provided temporary disability program. The lack of access demonstrates structural inequality. The majority of Minnesota workers are excluded. Those who are currently left out of the paid family and medical leave programs are often those who need the access the most and are facing the most economic insecurity. Lower paid employees are disproportionately left out of the paid family leave program. Black, Indigenous, and Latinx workers and other workers of color are less likely to have access, and women are also facing disparities when it comes to access to paid leave programs. Most Minnesota workers cannot afford to take time off without pay. Without access to wage replacement, workers with serious health conditions put off treatment or return to work sooner than recommended, jeopardizing recovery and long-term health. Unfortunately, there is a legacy in this country of inequities and occupational segregation that has resulted in uneven safety nets. In fact, when the Social Security Act was passed, there were exemptions that did not allow farmers or domestics to participate, and as a result, 65% of Black people across the country were ineligible for benefits. Today, in Minnesota, we see inequities in who has access to the safety net of paid family and medical leave and those who do not. The current system serves to deepen unacceptable disparities and inequality in the state. The holes in the safety net are so large, the majority of our hardworking and lowest income Minnesota families are falling through. The key to this bill is that it would ensure that the vast majority of hardworking Minnesotans would not be placed in the impossible choice of caring for themselves, a loved one, or a paycheck. A serious illness or injury can devastate a family's economic security quickly, as many Minnesotans are only one, two, or a few paychecks away from financial disaster. In the midst of a global pandemic, it has become even more clear. Illness can strike at any time, and families, just like businesses, need safety nets. The National Partnership for Women and Families has conducted national surveys on paid family leave, and in the most recent survey, 84% of all voters support permanent paid family leave programs. A state-operated paid family and medical leave insurance program has the potential to improve economic stability, retention of employment, and health outcomes. In the U.S., nearly one-third of women who give birth do not take any maternity leave. One in four women return to work within 2 weeks of giving birth. Paid leave matters for child health and development. Women who have access to paid leave are 93% more likely to be in the workforce in 9 to 12 months after a child's birth than women who take no leave. For women who do not have access to leave, the study found that nearly 30% will drop out of the workforce within a year after welcoming a child, and one in five will not return for over a decade. Working families with paid leave are more economically secure and are significantly less likely to use public support programs in the year after a child's birth. Employers benefit through increased employee retention, reduced turnover, and increased loyalty and morale. Paid leave boosts labor force participation. It is an economic policy lever. Minnesotans want to work and they want to take care of their families, and this bill can help make that a reality. We also have the added benefit and ability to take advantage of lessons learned from other states that have implemented similar programs that have proven effective, beneficial, and sustainable, even in the midst of the COVID pandemic. I have some author testifiers with me today, Mr. Chair, and would request that you recognize Ms. Deb Fitzpatrick.
Ms. Deb Fitzpatrick, welcome to the Workforce and Business Development Committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor, committee members. Appreciate the opportunity to be here today. My name is Deborah Fitzpatrick. I am the Director of Policy and Legislative Affairs at Children's Defense Fund. I have a couple of quick slides I'd like to show to ground the committee in how this program is structured, if that would be okay.
Yes, please proceed.
All right. So as I mentioned, my name is Deb Fitzpatrick, and I am here also in a capacity as the lead for the research team that conducted Minnesota's design and implementation study. This was a legislatively mandated study done in 2016 and updated in 2019. So the policy that we're hearing today is grounded in that background research. So first of all, just to lay out, this program is structured as a contributory social insurance program, and that is the dominant way that this type of benefit is delivered in eight other U.S. states and most countries around the world. That just means that most employers and workers are contributing into a state fund based on their wages. For an average worker making around $52,000 a year, that would be about $3 for the employer and $3 for the employee. There are a couple of exceptions. Employers with comparable benefits can provide their own program. and self-employed folks and contractors can choose to join the program. Eligibility for the program is based on attachment to the workforce and earnings, plus the need for an eligible leave. Important to also note that healthcare providers, in most cases, are certifying the need for the leave, and then workers make a claim on the state for the support that they need while they're on leave. And as Representative Richardson mentioned, House File 1200 builds on many unemployment insurance definitions and processes. That's to help reduce employer burdens so that it's sort of seamless between the way those two programs are operating. And it helps us ensure a successful build out, including the ability to clone many of the UI elements of UI. So there's many reasons that social insurance is the dominant model. I think the most important one is that it creates the benefit as a portable benefit. I think that's particularly important as we look at the number changes in our workforce, where we see a number of workers either having multiple employers at the same time or, you know, switching employers mid-year. This program then allows those all those employment situations and earnings to kind of be stacked together and create behind the scenes to make sure that workers, again, this is one of those structural elements, many low-wage workers working those part-time jobs or multiple part-time jobs do not currently qualify for benefits in any one of those employment situations. It also creates the broadest possible risk pool, and that keeps the cost really low for everyone. The bill allows those costs to be split equally between workers and employers. I think it's also important to note that it levels the benefits playing field in a number of ways, including geography and size of employer. And I think also important to say that, you know, the way the system works now, if you're an employer and you have employees that need to take leave, that responsibility falls completely on you, even though you as an employer don't really have control over whether your employees are going to need a leave. This system makes sure that we're all contributing so that every employer can offer that same level of benefit. And finally, it's a durable and popular approach. Because everyone is contributing into the program, it's an earned benefit, and then everyone has the opportunity to have access to this safety net when they need it. So with that, I'll stop and I'll be available for questions later on.
Thank you so much for your presentation. The next person on the list is, I believe, is Ms. Settle. Welcome to the committee and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Nonoko Sato, and I'm the Associate Director at the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, a state association with over 2,200 member nonprofits across the entire state. Minnesota nonprofits play an important role in Minnesota's communities, providing essential services, employing local residents, and improving qualities of life, and represents 14% of the Minnesota's workforce. MCN supports paid medical family leave legislation. It is a step towards supporting nonprofit strengths and sustainability as a viable and competitive employers. Providing living wages, offering strong benefits, and supporting staff will be crucial for the sector to attract and retain professionals who work tirelessly to meet the rising demands of our communities. MCN's report from 2018 showed that 72% of Minnesota nonprofits had less than 6 months of cash on hand. And it's important to note here that not all cash are unrestricted and therefore cannot be used for emergencies. Many nonprofits are currently facing increased demand for services while funding sources remain unpredictable. Small organizations in particular would benefit from systems that would allow smaller payments in installment for future needs, rather than having to pay a large and possibly unexpected sum someday in the future. A valuable employee should not have to choose between keeping a steady paycheck and supporting the needs of one's family, which disproportionately impacts women and Black and Indigenous and people of color, as evidenced and exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. Losing a staff member during a family emergency can be catastrophic, not just for the employer, but for the communities that they serve. For the employer, paid family medical leave will help small nonprofits minimize the hardship of losing a staff person during a family emergency, but not by not having to choose between paying the staff on leave and thereby increasing their chances of returning to the workforce and having emergency funds to temporarily cover their work. This legislation will provide many benefits to employers, employees, and Minnesota overall while reducing racial disparities. On behalf of MCN and the Minnesota nonprofit sector, we ask all members of this committee to please vote in favor of HF 1200. Thank you.
Thank you. The next person on the list is Ms. Jost. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. I am Nancy Jost. I'm the Director of Early Childhood at West Central Initiative, which is based in Fergus Falls, and we are one of the six Minnesota Initiative Foundations. So there are many reasons that I support House File 1200 paid family medical leave legislation, and I would like to highlight a few of them today. We have a child care shortage in Minnesota, and especially in rural Minnesota. And infant care is scarcer and more expensive than care for older toddlers and preschoolers, both for both providers and parents. Paid family medical leave would help alleviate that shortage. Small employers in rural Minnesota are less likely to be able to offer this benefit on their own, and so this would help them attract employees. In rural Minnesota, pregnant moms and parents of young children often must drive quite a distance to healthcare facilities, and so this would give them the opportunity to have time off to make that drive to attend to the health of their children and themselves. The research is clear that infants and toddlers need nurturing, responsive care and to have engaging, stimulating interactions to help their brains grow during the foundational prenatal to three period. Paid family medical leave would allow for that to take place. More than half of moms return to work within a year of giving birth, and one in four mothers return within just 2 weeks. Paid family medical leave would allow parents to stay home and to bond with their children. A variety of health and social benefits happen when parents are able to take paid time off from work immediately after the birth or adoption of a child. The availability of paid family leave promotes better overall outcomes for families. And lastly, paid leave also facilitates greater parental attachment to the labor force in the long term. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you so much. The next person is Ms. Lorraine Skortos. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
For the record, my name is Lauren Schotthorst, and I'm the Director of Workplace Management and Workforce Development Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm speaking today representing the Chamber's 6,300 businesses and 500,000 employees. The majority of our members are small and mid-sized businesses. I'm also speaking on behalf of the Chamber Federation, which represents more than 43 local chambers and 21,000 businesses, the Minnesota Manufacturers Coalition, which represents a wide range of individual manufacturing associations across the state, and the United for Jobs Coalition, which represents nearly 80 state organizations and their hundreds of thousands of employees in opposition to House File 1200. In light of time constraints, I have submitted my full remarks as written testimony and a one-page document co-signed by the coalition members I just mentioned. With that, I will begin my testimony. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I am testifying today to reiterate the top message we have shared with the legislature on behalf of the Minnesota business community. Minnesota's economic recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic must be the top priority for this session. We oppose attempts to impose unworkable, one-size-fits-all paid leave mandates because of the variety and nuances of workplaces across Minnesota. With massive pandemic-driven changes to work rules and conditions, state-driven cost burdens matter all the more. Minnesota employers provide employees with innovative and robust benefits, promoting wellness and flexibility while maintaining the ability to operate safely and manage a variety of workplaces across the state. Employers in our state currently must also adhere to a strict set of labor laws and workplace standards at all levels of government in order to maintain safe, healthy, respectful, and inclusive workplaces. Within the current regulatory regime, employers must have the autonomy to make staffing decisions and provide wages, benefits, and schedules that are appropriate for their workplace and responsive to workplace needs. House File 1200 places a new payroll tax on every employer to create a broad new state-run insurance program that will collectively cost the Minnesota business community $2.2 billion over its first 3 years. In addition to the direct cost on employers, the proposal will conservatively take years of development and hundreds of state full-time employees to start, implement, and administrate at a time when state agencies are completely overleveraged due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Most importantly, this proposal creates a mechanism for an employee to be away from their job for up to 24 weeks in a year. That's 44% of a working year. Furthermore, this bill requires employers to maintain specific records in a specific format or risk significant fines and liabilities for a set of benefits that a majority of our members are already offering their employees in some form. In a time of economic recovery, the Chamber and its partners support a do-no-harm approach that limits additional cost burdens and mandates on employers, particularly small employers. You may hear from some small businesses today who have a different perspective, but I want to be clear that they do not speak for the members I am speaking on behalf of. As I mentioned earlier, the majority of the Chamber's 6,300 members are small and mid-sized businesses. And I encourage you to look through our list of partners on the back of the United for Jobs one-pager I submitted, who represent small businesses too. Over 43 local chambers and organizations, such as the Realtors, the Grocers, and our state's chapter of the National Federation of Independent Businesses, America's Small and Independent Business Owners Advocate, all of who compromise our state's small businesses, who are doing their best to keep their doors open and Minnesotans employed. For these reasons, our collective organizations respectfully encourage a no vote on House File 1200 and appreciate the opportunity to share our opposition with the committee today. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much, Ms. Shorthost. I appreciate it. And the next person is Ms. Harris. Welcome to the committee and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Liz Harris. I am a family child care provider in Cottage Grove, a former member of the Minnesota State Child Care Task Force, and a member of Main Street Alliance. When I had my first child, I worked as a treasury analyst for a Fortune 100 company. I was provided with 12 weeks of paid maternity leave. I needed the time because I had a C-section for each of my three children. I only closed for 1 week after my second and third were born, because I didn't want to make the parents scramble for care or further disrupt the consistency that children need. I brought in another provider to substitute for me for the next 7 weeks. Both of these maternity leaves were unpaid. As a former treasury analyst, I am good with money, and while it was difficult, was able to budget for this time without pay, even with the slim profit margins involved in the family child care. But of course, you can only plan for the things you can foresee. On March 3rd, 2015, my sister-in-law, Holly Hoagland Klein, was on Interstate 94 traveling to work when a semi slammed into her, causing a 9-car pileup, killing her on impact. She was 44 years old, and she was the owner of Hoagland Bus Company. She left behind my brother and their 3 young children. I had just fed my daycare kids lunch that day, and I was 7 months pregnant when I received the call. I became more than an aunt that day to my niece and nephews as I became their main caretaker. I again had to take some unpaid time off, adding stress and financial disruption to an already tragic situation. If Minnesota had a paid family medical leave program like the one in this bill, it would make a huge difference for family child care providers, helping us manage planned and unplanned events and providing a level of financial security. It would help address racial and economic disparities that would make situations like the ones I faced even more challenging. It would make the field of family child care more attractive to those considering it and to current providers like me. As the pandemic has highlighted, our economy cannot run without child care. Our economy will collapse without child care. We are essential to the economy, the state, and the families we serve, and we receive little to no business supports or incentives. This is the least the state should do to help family child care providers stay in business and grow the field. Please support House File 1200. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person that I have on the list is Shannon, Ms. Shannon Burns. Welcome to the committee introduce itself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Nora and members. My name is Shannon Burns. I'm a small business consultant and small business owner in Alexandria. I work with small businesses in West Central region of Minnesota and across the state, and I'm a member of the Main Street Alliance. The best way to describe my feelings and the feelings of small business owners I work with regarding the pandemic is that it's been an emotional roller coaster. We've gotten through the shock period of the last year and are working to adjust to this new normal. That makes the choices you make about the state budget and support for working families and small businesses even more important. With the right support, small business owners can start to figure out how to thrive now and in the future. The pandemic shined a bright light on the need for policies like paid family and medical leave that gives people the ability to take time to quarantine or care for themselves and their loved ones. So many small businesses that I work with have had to be without their staff for weeks at a time, sometimes more than once in the last year, and it's only put them even further behind. Luckily, the federal government provided businesses with a limited amount of paid medical time off, allowing businesses to pay their staff what they had to be off because they were sick, had to quarantine, or care for a loved one. Being able to provide this type of benefit was a first for most small businesses in Alexandria and other areas of greater Minnesota, one that shouldn't end with the pandemic. Small business owners in greater Minnesota need to be able to continue to provide paid family medical leave to their employees, but they need the state's help to do so. Only the state can provide a big enough pool to make this type of benefit accessible and affordable for us. I believe that teleworking is going to be the new norm for white-collar employees. This is good news for greater Minnesota because it will help us retain and grow our populations, as people won't have to choose between living in a smaller community they love and working for a larger corporation with great benefits. It means, however, that businesses on Main Street in Alexandria, the key to our tourist industry, will have to compete more directly with large corporations for employees. Actually, all small businesses in greater Minnesota, which provide the majority of jobs outside of the Twin Cities metro area, will need to compete with large corporations that can afford to offer paid family medical leave programs. Communities from Alexandria to Albert Lea and everywhere in between need the state to help level the playing field for small businesses that are critical to our community's futures. Please support House File 1200. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person is Ms. Sarah Pippenberg. Welcome to the committee and introduce yourself for the record. You're muted.
Oops, sorry. Thank you, Chair Noor and members. My name is Sarah Pippenberg, and I'm the co-owner of Vinaigrette, a family-owned food store located in Southwest Minneapolis, and I'm a member of Main Street Alliance. 2 years ago, one of my most valued long-term employees, Linda, fell and broke both of her arms. She was unable to work. As a widow in her 60s with only a small pension from the telephone company, she had taken a job in our store to make sure her ends met. If she went without her paycheck from us while she was out recovering, she was going to have to choose between putting food on the table and making rent. We couldn't accept that as employers. We decided to cover Linda's full pay while she was out, which totaled $2,000. I was happy we did it, but it impacted my family, having to cover these extra shifts. And on top of that, trying to make sure Linda received her pay, our family was late on our home mortgage and commercial rent payments. I've looked into plans available on the private market, and the best option would cost 50% more than what is in this proposal. It only offers 6 weeks time off. It excludes coverage for cancer and requires a health screening. In other words, private market options are unaffordable and substandard, as far as I'm concerned. This shouldn't be such a struggle for any of us. This bill creates a system where everyone pays in a little, everyone benefits. I support this policy, and the majority of small businesses agree. A recent survey of 600 small business owners found overwhelming support for public paid level leave policies. There was a majority support across party lines. Another survey also showed that, like me, the vast majority of small business owners, 84%, are not able to provide paid leave on their own. And a said social insurance program would help them offer paid leave to their employees, helping them attract and retain dedicated employees like Linda and avoiding the cost in replacing her. Small business owners and our employees alike need a paid leave program like the one in House Bill, House File 1200. Thank you.
Thank you so much. The next person is Ms. Peterson. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
My name is Lynn Peterson, and I am a cook currently on medical leave from the Fridley Public Schools. I'm a member of the SEIU Local 284. Our union of 9,000 hourly school workers is majority women and people of color, and all our members love caring for others. In fact, that is why most of us do this work. All of us do a lot of unpaid caregiving too for children and parents when they get older and when we need time also to take care of ourselves. I've lived with chronic pancreatitis since I was 16. I've had my appendix, gallbladder, spleen, part of my small intestine, and pancreas removed. I've had an auto islet transplant so that my body could produce some insulin. Before my big surgery, I was on a feeding tube for 3 years, and after my big surgery, I needed a full year to recover. Even after all of that, I continue to have health issues and I'm at high risk for illness and infections. My doctor recommended against me going to work during the pandemic, but Fridley School District did a pretty good job of implementing COVID protections and I felt safe enough to go into work. Now as the school is opening up and more students are in the lunchroom, going to work no longer feels safe to me. That's why I'm on unpaid medical leave until I'm fully vaccinated. Even after the pandemic is over, I still am going to need to take off time from work to care for my children. I am a mother of a 10 and 12-year-old, and my daughter has severe asthma. When she's in the red zone, she needs nebulizers every 3 hours and inhalers every 4 hours. Sometimes she needs to be hospitalized, and sometimes I am able to care for her at home. But either way, I need to take time off work for this. I do as much as I can to take care of myself and my family around work hours, but sometimes you just need to be there. As an hourly worker, I've gotten used to not having time paid off when I care for myself and others, but it does not have to be this way. We can have policies that put the health, safety, and well-being of our families first. I'm here today fully in support of this bill because every family in Minnesota, no matter our race, wealth, job, or zip code, should have paid medical and family leave. We shouldn't have to choose between prioritizing care for our loved ones and getting a paycheck. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person is Ms. DeRose. I think I'm getting a little bit of an echo. Oh, that's good. So welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ruth DeRose. I'm a registered nurse and I live in Bemidji with my husband and my three children. I'm here today to support paid family and medical leave. As a nurse, I understand how important it is for parents to bond with their children after birth or adoption. This time is critical to bonding, establishing breastfeeding, and allowing a mother's body to heal and recover from the birthing experience, which is shown by research to take 1 year. While I was able to have access to paid maternity leave through my employer, I'm required to use my own PTO to cover that paid time after the birth of a child. Therefore, 3 years before trying to have a child, I stopped taking vacation and saved time in order to not need to choose between the health of our child and our economic stability. With each pregnancy, the amount of time I was able to take was less. By the time we had our third child, I was only able to take home the equivalent of 24 hours a month of pay during that leave. This was a heavy burden to consider. It left little to no room for me to be able to remain home in the event of a sick child or being sick myself. The stress of returning to work was increased because finding infant care in Greater Minnesota is extremely difficult. I have actually never been able to establish formal part-time infant daycare and have not had the resources to pay for full-time care, which at times can require paying monthly for 9 months in advance to ensure a spot. I know I found it challenging to balance these needs, and I have access to some form of paid leave, but there are many families in my community who are not as fortunate. I have a coworker who came back to work only 3 weeks after giving birth, which was not healthy for her nor her baby. I think it is critically important to family stability and our community viability to provide this important insurance to all families if possible. Young families should not be forced to choose between their health and financial stability. Please support paid family and medical leave. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person is Tony Mangskow, if I'm correct with the last name. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Tony K. Mangskow, and I'm here from Rochester, and I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to share my family's story. I'm here on behalf of AARP. Minnesota's population is aging, and family caregivers are the backbone of our long-term care system. As a family caregiver, I'm providing care to my mom, who has cancer, and my developmentally disabled brother, whom I became guardian for when my parents' health started to fail. My caregiving has included household tasks, grocery shopping, coordinating and attending medical appointments, filling out necessary paperwork, communicating with insurance providers, driving them to appointments, to more complex tasks like setting up medications and wound care. I've done all of this while working full time. It's a challenging job, but my family needs me. Up until a couple of years ago, my mom was living independently in an apartment setting. I believe she would have been able to remain in this setting for a longer period of time if I wasn't trying to balance a full-time job and caregiving needs all at the same time. She now resides in an assisted care living facility. We had to exhaust all of her assets, and her care is now paid through medical assistance. There were many tears shed when I knew that the mom who had spent so many years raising me to become independent would now be losing her own independence. I work in cancer research, and I hear from other caregivers with similar experiences. Through the years, as a family caregiver, it's been a financial strain. During a 9-month period in 2017, I went without 1/3 of my yearly income due to unpaid time away from work. I've declared bankruptcy in the past. I wasn't able to afford unpaid time away from work, keep a roof over my family's head, buy groceries, pay utilities, and other necessary expenses along the way. In the past 2 months, my mom has been hospitalized twice, spent time in a skilled nursing facility, and most recently was told she needed to switch her cancer medication to a drug that's going to be administered through an IV in an outpatient setting monthly, and she'll need to have family with her. So I'm not sure what the future is going to bring for my family, but regardless, like so many Minnesotans do every day, whether the time away from their jobs is paid or not paid, I will be away from work to provide the support that my family needs. Having guaranteed paid time away from work to care for my family would ease so much stress related to my finances. Every caregiver's story may be unique, but yet they still are the same. We do anything for our loved ones. The value of a family's emotional support and presence during a loved one's illness cannot be measured, and it should not be degraded or punished by the fear of financial difficulty. As caregiving becomes the new normal, more and more Minnesotans will likely be caregivers during their lifetime. No one should ever have to live with making a choice between not paying their bills and sacrificing their loved one's well-being. It's time for Minnesota lawmakers to pass a paid family and medical leave program. A growing army of Minnesota family caregivers are counting on you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The last person on my list is Ms. Swanland. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Maggie Swanland, and I live in South Minneapolis. I'm also a teacher and a peer coach through the QComp program in Wayzata Public Schools. But most importantly, I am a new mom to a 6-month-old little daughter. I'm here today to share my experiences and my support for paid family medical leave. Over the past year, I experienced my first pregnancy in the midst of a global pandemic. As an essential worker, I questioned the safety and security of my job. During a time that could have been full of joy and anticipation, I felt the fear and the stress of making decisions about my maternity leave and the impact that would have on my paycheck, my benefits, and the health of my family. I was fortunately able to decide and take an extended and unpaid leave. I believe that paid family medical leave would have supported me through my first pregnancy and helped me transition into motherhood. I used all of my sick days for my leave, days that I had accumulated over 10 years in education. And additionally, I had to take some leave without pay. I extended that leave. But most importantly, I think that paid family medical leave can support my family as we decide to have a second child or have other medical needs. I'm really fortunate that I had the opportunity to take those sick days and use that as my maternity leave. But the pandemic isn't over and I have no sick leave left. I can only imagine the heartbreak of families who do not have access to this luxury. Those who can't afford to take unpaid leave and those who have to make really hard decisions for their family. In Wayzata Public Schools, we have a mission to serve each and every in an equitable way. And as Minnesotans, I know the value of working toward a greater good. I believe that HF 1200 can support each and every Minnesotan. Please pass HF 1200. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your testimony. I see Representative Beck has already raised his hand. Please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, if you had other things to cover, I was kind of waiting until the end. So is this the right time?
It's the right time, yeah.
Mr. Chair and members. Representative Richardson, I guess I had a few questions for you as the author of the bill. As you understand, I'm a small employer, and I support family medical leave. I think that the concept is right. I think most employers are doing it now. And if they're not, there's a really good reason probably why they're not. My question, I think, initially is, and I might have a couple here, Mr. Chair, but Representative Richardson, you are bringing in sort of the whole enchilada on this thing, that all employees are part of this. We want to go all in with 12 weeks. It could go up to 26 weeks. Have you talked with some of the business associations that have had some concerns about how we could find a pathway to kind of step into this better and maybe not go in all so quickly? Have you had a chance to think about something new, maybe with 6 weeks, not 12, having a line of 50 employees, not all employers, because there's a reason why the smallest employers are gonna really struggle with this when they're literally talking about 3 to 5 employees. And I know there's some grant money and there's some things we can do, but finding temporary help in a grant is just not possible these days. So Representative Richardson, can you help me with just understanding why we're not taking this a little bit slower for those small employers like me?
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Baker, for the questions. There are a couple of things that I think it's important to highlight, because right now in Minnesota, we know that the vast majority of Minnesotan workers do not have access to paid family and medical leave. And while there are some employers who are providing it, what we know is that when we look at sort of who has access, who doesn't have access, there are some deep inequities that we see there, particularly around some of the lowest paid Minnesotan workers as well. And so, you know, part of the thought process behind this is ensuring that we're extending a safety net that covers the individuals who are oftentimes most in need and most at risk of financial disaster. And so knowing that they are kept out of this safety net right now, I think that that's an important consideration to have, because historically we've had sort of these uneven safety nets where we tend to see individuals who likely could afford to miss a few or several paychecks will often have access to paid family leave, and individuals who are living paycheck to paycheck do not. And so I think from a structural inequality piece, that there's an equity argument to be made about extending the safety net more equitably across the entire state. In terms of conversations, there's been a lot of conversations around this bill with those who support and those who do not currently support the bill as well. And as with any bill, you know, this is a starting point and very open to conversations, very open to working with individuals and be open to talking with you more and working with you as well. Because I think at the end of the day, in terms of just thinking about the timing of this, we're long overdue. And I think the COVID pandemic has shined a bright light on some of the challenges and some of the and some of the inequities that are here. What we have built out here is really based upon some lessons that we've learned from other states. And I think from a research perspective, we have a little bit of information that we have been able to gather through the University of Minnesota for those who do have access to paid family leave and medical leave to see how Minnesotans are using it. And what we know is about 13% of Minnesotans have, you know, access, you know, to paid family leave through an employer. And when we look at the percentage that have access that are taking it, it's about 13.6% who take it within any given year. And the average that they are taking is about 6.6 weeks of time off. So that was a lot of talking, but to say, happy to continue to have conversations around that.
Representative Beck.
Mr. Chair, thanks. And Representative Richardson, thank you for that. I think I don't disagree with what you said about the equities and where they're coming from. Why do you think, Representative Richardson, that those employers that are the smallest employers are not doing the family leave now like the other big ones are? What is happening? Do you think those employers don't care as much as the big employers, or what is stopping them from offering that now?
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Baker, for the question. I think that we can get some thought process from that, from what we've heard today, from some of those small business owners who are on this call today. Part of this is really about leveling the playing field for them as well, because what they have really laid out is the challenges that small businesses have when they're competing with larger employers. They don't have sort of this level playing field as it comes to being able to offer benefits like paid family medical leave. And so by having this model of where premiums are paid in and we've got a larger safety net from a benefits perspective, what many of the smallest businesses are saying is this is an opportunity to level the playing field so that we can compete with the larger companies to be able to attract workers. And I know that, you know, some of the things that I've heard from some of the smaller businesses as well is, you know, sometimes they have people who want to work for them, but they just can't afford to, knowing that they wouldn't be able to have access to things like paid family medical leave. So I think it's, again, it's an opportunity to be able to create a more level playing field for businesses of different sizes.
And just final follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir, President Beck. Bye.
Thank you very much. And again, I appreciate that. I think, you know, we're seeing a lot of that in Minnesota. And again, I think a lot of the language that I'm seeing in this bill is very similar to what we saw in 2019. And I'm not sure if you were the chief author on that as well, Ms. Richardson, or Representative Richardson, but a lot has changed, right, in the last 12 months. And the small businesses got hammered much more than the big ones did now. And I find it really kind of hard to get my head around. Again, I like this concept of starting with the right steps and a right process so that we can bring something like this to Minnesota in a way that we get more collaboration and more building this policy in the right way. I really think we need to have people like the Minnesota Chamber and hospitality companies and folks to say, let's work on something that makes sense. I'm guessing right now a lot of them are really nervous that we're all in on this thing and we cannot take such a large chunk. And I'm hoping that if you want to seriously get moving with this process, we've got to make it in the steps of the right steps so that you know, businesses like mine can offer things like this, because we're already offering a lot of really cool stuff for my employees now. That's very customized to our employee base. So I offer my hand to you. I offer my help as an employer. I support this kind of a concept. I think employers can't afford not to, because there aren't enough employees to bring into our companies. And we can't do well as a company if we don't recruit and retain more employees. So again, I urge you to tap the brakes on the package, the enormity of this package. Listen to people like associations, even myself. This is too much for the small employers. I hope that we can come up with a stepped approach that is much more palatable on the front end, especially after small businesses have been hammered in 2020. So thank you for your time, members, and I'll yield my time.
Thank you. Chair Richardson, did you want to comment on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Baker, for your questions and also for your comments as well. And I didn't carry this bill last session. It was actually former Representative Halverson who carried it previously. And you're right, since this bill was carried last time, we've had a lot of changes as it relates to the COVID pandemic. But one of the things that I think has stayed the same since pre-COVID and now deep in the midst of the COVID pandemic is the deep disparities of access, of who has access and who doesn't have access. And so I think that the COVID pandemic has made things worse for many populations who are already facing a lot of challenges and a lot of struggles. And what we know right now is that for the lowest income workers, they are three times more likely to lose their job when they are taking leave. And so the domino effect that occurs from that as well is another piece of this sort of structural inequality conversation that I think is really key to this. That's really key to this as well. And I think in the midst of the COVID pandemic as a state, we've stepped up for businesses. And at the federal level, there was a step up for businesses, be it the grants that were distributed to businesses, funding for counties to go to businesses, the payroll protection loans. Those were all indicators of the fact that sometimes businesses need a safety net. And so this is just really an extension of that, that the people who power the businesses, they have families and they sometimes need a safety net as well. And so again, glad to continue conversations with you, and I really appreciate your willingness to continue to work on this issue and to continue to have conversations. I am an employer as well, and so I know that there's challenges out there from an employer perspective, and happy to work on those. So thank you again.
Thank you. Members, we'll limit the questions to two, just to make sure that we can get back to you just in case we have got more time. The next person is Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative, for bringing this bill. Two questions. Okay. Let me see if I can narrow this down then. I guess I'll start with some comments. You know, I want to echo a lot of what Representative Baker is saying. And partially, I agree with the COVID thing, but I also don't want to use that as a cop-out either. We've been in this position for a long time, being small business employers and having employee issues and wanting to offer the best to our employees. I would agree with you, Representative Richardson, that I would love to compete. I would love to be able to do the same things as the bigger corporations. And what I see a lot of in this bill is we're actually going to be saving large corporations and companies lots of money, because what we're going to see is the vacation pay, sick pay, personal time off, it's going to disappear because we're relinquishing that to the government. And that kind of scares me a little bit. But on the flip side, as a small business owner, I want to be able to do the same. So I think we're going to have to watch out for that, because why would I offer a benefit to an employee that the government's going to offer for me? So that brings me to some of my questions. Let's start with in the bill, it says that certain, if you're receiving certain benefits or payments or wages, like let's say, this might all kind of be one question, I guess. Private disability insurance, is that included as line 27.13, it states workers' compensation disability insurance offset. Is that only for work comp through the state or disability insurance through the state or the federal? Or does that also include, like, if somebody's paying for Aflac or something like that on the subset, you know, how people pick up extra policies to cover themselves a little bit more to make sure they're overly insured on disability? Would that be included as an offset for payment on this policy?
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Frankie, for the questions. And you know, and one thing I do just want to highlight related to the comment that you had made about larger corporations as well. The way that the bill is drafted, large corporations have the opportunity to continue with their own plans if they are in fact comparable. And what I've heard from you know, some of the folks who are members of the chamber is that they actually have plans that are more generous than what is within this bill. And there would be nothing that would prevent them from continuing to offer a plan that would be more generous to their employees. And as it relates to this program, you know, employers would have the option. They would have the option of providing their own comparable plan, and that could be something that they just provide themselves. They would have the option of continuing to rely on, looking at disability, different products that might be out there that they may be currently using in order to build out a program. And so in terms of, you know, the question that I think the question that you're asking is around the fact that if someone is opting out of being a part of the state-run plan, what they would be required to do as an employer, and they would just have to meet the same levels in terms of thinking about leave that this plan offers through the paid family leave portion of it, and then also the medical leave portion of that as well.
Representative Frank.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Richardson. I think I lost you in that question a little bit. Maybe I went around the way a little bit too much. What I'm talking about are things that are exempted and things that are acceptable as far as wages or exemptions on the payouts of the program. Like for instance, and this one kind of gets me sideways a little bit, Social Security disability, it starts at line 28.15. It shows that you cannot receive your Social Security disability at the same time as receiving this benefit. But as a person, I'm paying in taxes on both benefits. So therefore, wouldn't I be, I guess, owed both benefits? I'm getting taxed and pay into a system, and now I can only collect on one. I'll have to look a little bit more further into that. But then at line 28.8, we exempt employer paid, so you can collect on this program and still receive vacation pay, sick pay, personal time off pay, supplemental benefit pay. So you can double dip on your employer, but you can't double dip on the government, which you are paying into, which if I'm reading all this correctly, now, once again, I am just a glorified dishwasher and I will try to look further into this, but that just kind of upsets me that the government takes my money and I can't collect on both systems. But yet if my employer is paying me money, I can take his money and the government money. So to me, it should be either one way or the other, or, you know what I mean? It both should be either allowable or not allowable. But I agree with you. I'm going to try and keep this quick as I can, and say that I support this concept as Representative Baker does, and I do want to be able to compete, and I do want small businesses and everybody to receive these potential benefits. I see the potential in the program. Now, how do we get there? How does this compare with the other bill that's working through the system? I don't know. This bill as it stands, I do have a lot of questions. Like I said, I need to take more time. It's quite a large bill and very extensive, and come up with some ideas and maybe some potential amendments that you will work with me on. So I think I'm going to give you an affirmative vote out of this committee. Don't know if I will at any point in time going forward unless I can see some changes. But yeah, there's just some things like that. And, you know, let's make it clear across the board for all these situations. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Richardson.
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Frankie. And, you know, and in terms of thinking about how this bill will intersect with, you know, other programs, you know, things like FMLA, you know, we did do some work around ensuring that this sort of leave would run concurrently. And you mentioned about the exemptions as it related to sort of vacation and sick leave. Ms. Fitzpatrick may have more to say on the issue, but I also just want to thank you for extending an offer to continue conversations around this as well, and would be happy to do that with you as well. Mr. Chair, if you would like Ms. Fitzpatrick to expand more.
Ms. Fitzpatrick, please go ahead and make it brief.
Yeah, I'll try to make it brief, and I'm happy to maybe schedule a time to talk about the intricacies of this with you, Representative Frankie. We are really looking also at how the UI program deals with the offset. I mean, at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is make sure that workers are kind of held harmless during these leaves so that they're getting, you know, their normal income is available to them to support themselves and their families during a leave, but not so that they're getting a lot more of that. So it is challenging to think about those intersections. I will say that in terms of like the temporary disability plans and things like that, we've learned from how these programs work in these other states. Oftentimes those are used to top off the state benefits. So again, sort of on top of if the state benefit is 2/3 of your income, then people can use their sick leave to kind of make up that difference between the 2/3 and full pay. Sometimes now they have temporary disability policies that do that topping up for employers. So it is a little bit complicated at the intersection, and I'm happy to have a conversation offline with you.
Thank you. I just wanted to note that in this committee, we actually addressed the Social Security disability benefit when it comes to the UI. In fact, we made the recommendation to remove the cap for the 50%. In fact, we're one of the few states that is still doing that. So definitely as we make the changes under the UI, the underlying bill will also reflect those changes. I'll go to Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Richardson, for bringing this bill forward. It always feels a little visceral. I'm sure we all have stories, but I remember when I was pregnant with my daughter and my mom was diagnosed with cancer, and I was going over after her surgeries to change her bandages almost daily as she lives alone. And I had this baby growing in my belly, and my husband and I kind of had this, you know, really scary thought about what's our life going to look like and what's the kind of care we're going to have to be giving to potentially to a new baby and a mother with a debilitating illness. And so in thinking about that and thinking about my own situation, and I know in this committee we talk about the caregiving crisis as it relates to workforce. And we obviously know in the state of Minnesota we're in a caregiving crisis, both for, as I mentioned, you know, for our littlest ones and for our elderly and our aging. And so I was wondering if you could talk about how your bill helps to address that caregiving crisis we're experiencing in Minnesota. I think it's really pertinent to this committee in particular.
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Olson, for your question as well. And I think that the opportunity that we have with advancing a paid family medical leave bill, and as it relates to sort of that caregiving crisis that we are experiencing within, you know, not only our state, but in the nation as well, but focusing on Minnesota, there is an opportunity in here to help support families that are caring for seniors or are caring for their elders. What we've seen in other states that have adopted programs, there's been less usage of nursing home facilities because individuals have the opportunity to care for their family members. And so not only are there positive outcomes as a result of those familial connections, but it also is very helpful to the bottom line of not only the state, but the federal government as well. And also thinking of it from the perspective of those who are taking leave to care for a new child and thinking about bonding as well. There are a lot of benefits that have been identified as a result of paid family leave programs. It is a way to address the infant mortality crisis that we are experiencing within the state. It's also a way to address and reduce the number of preterm births that are occurring, which has extensive costs, not only to family members, but to the state as well, because, you know, when babies are born premature, and if they have to start their life within intensive care units, those are costs that are currently borne by families and by the state as well. And also thinking about the reduction in the number of low birth weight babies that are born as well. And so there are a number of benefits that come in terms of having family members being able to care for their loved ones, for their children, and also the ability to more effectively breastfeed as well. That has a whole host of benefits in the short term, long term, and also just thinking about the overall brain development of little ones with the opportunity for not only breastfeeding, but that essential needed bonding in those early months.
Representative Olson.
Nothing more, Mr. Chair, but thank you, Representative Richardson, for your work. I know this is a heavy lift, but it's an important lift, so thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I kind of think back to my days and of when I was younger and listening to the radio, and, you know, there's always that Minnesotans always have like this kind of superiority complex, it feels like. You know, we think we're so great and we have the best programs and the best education system, and we're kind of starting to fall behind here. California, New Jersey, Rhode Island, New York, the District of Columbia, Washington, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Oregon all offer this benefit to their workers. You look at other countries, there's countries like Cameroon, 14 weeks at 100%, Algeria, 14 weeks, 100%. You know, I mean, this, we're falling behind. And not only that, but there's kind of a stigma when women take that time after they have a baby. And, you know, I was lucky enough to be able to bring my little one up to the Capitol, but I took 3 weeks. 3 weeks where I didn't worry about work or anything like that. And then, you know, started gradually bringing the baby up to the Capitol. And that benefited me. That benefited her. But I don't think that that should be something unique to my position or any other position. I think this is something that we have to do. And if we don't do it, we're going to lose our businesses to states that are that have these benefits. And so I am very grateful to the work you're doing, Representative Richardson. And I think we have to get this done to be competitive as a state.
Thank you. The next person is Representative Cortez-Otun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Richardson, for bringing this bill. This is the third time that I've had the pleasure to participate in a committee hearing on this topic. And as you know, it's a passion of mine personally. And so, I, you know, it feels a little bit like, you know, we've been able to address it from so many different perspectives. And so today, the focus I want to take is the fact that we are here again today. It's Equal Pay Day, the day which marks the extra time that it takes for the average woman in the United States to earn the same pay that their male counterparts in the United States earn the same pay previous in the calendar year. So Representative Richardson already mentioned that this average is worse for women of color. It's something that's also always used as an excuse for why women earn less than men is the fact that they take unpaid time away from work to serve as caregivers to children, most frequently, their parents possibly, or to recover from childbirth. You know, we discussed earlier in the session in this committee that 100% of the jobs lost in December belonged to women nationwide, that the coronavirus pandemic has had a disastrous impact disproportionately on women in the workforce. So if every Minnesota worker had access to paid family and medical leave, because this is a universal program, they need not worry that taking time away from work will impact their future earnings for the rest of their life. So this program would not only help Minnesotans in the workforce, it will be a benefit to employers too. And back in 2009, the Eastern Washington University Institute for Public Policy and Economic Analysis found that Washington employers incurred costs of $2.08 billion related to employee turnover or missed work due to childcare issues. And obviously this program impacts very, very quickly, that those first few months of the child's life, but also then kind of ongoing as parents need to step away from work to care for a sick child or a sick family member. So paid family medical leave will support workers and businesses across the state of Minnesota. While the United States continues to lag behind every other industrialized nation in the world, Minnesota doesn't have to. So we have the chance to take this step, pass this proposal, and support our workers, support our businesses. And I think that we need to do it right now. I appreciate the bill, and I urge everyone's support.
Thank you. Representative Hale.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Richardson. A lot of my questions and comments have been covered by other members, but if we could, I'd like, whether it's Representative Richardson or Representative Olson, to give me a short compare and contrast between House File 1200 here and House File 7, the Earn Sick and Safe Time that I believe we're going to be hearing on the floor tomorrow. So if you could, one of you wants to tackle that, that would be great. Thank you.
So I hear there's a need for a preview for tomorrow. So Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Haley, for the question. So as it relates to House File 1200, what we're talking about with paid family and medical leave would be leave that would be at least 7 days long, and would be related to either a serious medical condition that the employer would be facing personally, or a family member would be facing. And it would also apply for bonding leave as well to care for a child. And then also thinking about it with the kind of the big tent of pregnancy. We know that when individuals are pregnant, that they oftentimes will have multiple appointments. And so it would cover leave within that realm. From an earned sick and safe time perspective, it is thinking about the leave that individuals that they would take that would not hit that 7 day threshold. So if someone needed to take the day off to go to court, for example, because they were trying to get an order for protection, that would be an example of a leave that would not necessarily hit that 7 day threshold definition. Mr. Chair, I don't know if Representative Olson had more to add.
Representative Olson, did you have more to add, or you want to wait for tomorrow?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sure we will have ample conversation on the House floor. I think Chair Richardson said it well. The only thing I would mention that they work in tandem together. Earned sick and safe time is an accrued benefit. So it's accrued at 1 hour per 30 hours worked. And so it's a different model where, you know, obviously Chair Richardson has explained what the way this program would be set up. So this earned sick and safe time, the biggest difference is it's an accrued model and it's for shorter stints, as Chair Richardson. And again, I'm sure we'll talk about more tomorrow.
Thank you. Representative Haley.
So just to be clear, thank you, Representative Olson and Representative Richardson. These programs or mandates could be layered on top of each other. So an employee could have the 7-day earned sick and safe time and then move into a paid family leave benefit as well.
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Representative Haley, for the question. The eligibility for the programs are different. So this is, you know, House File 1200 is really related to, again, an individual having a serious health condition or caring for someone else, or from a bonding perspective. So the leave program for the on the medical side of things is related to a serious health condition. So they are two separate. They're two separate things. And as Representative Olson said, they do have the they're going to accrue differently in terms of how people are eligible for them. But that's how it would work with House File 1200 anyway.
Representative Haley, did you have a quick follow up?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative Joggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Richardson, I'm trying to get a handle on Article 3, the appropriations. There's some big numbers in there, but they're not all from the general fund. Some are appropriations from this plan or from this program. Have you been able to boil this down on an annual basis? How much funding would come from the general fund? And how much of it is self-sustaining?
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Juergens, for your question. And, you know, as it relates to the deed appropriations, in fiscal year 22 and 23, I'll start with fiscal year 2022, there would be a one-time appropriation that would be coming from the general fund to deed. And the idea is that those dollars would then be paid back once the fund is set up and established. In fiscal year 23, there is another $23 million appropriation that is written into the bill. And the idea would be that those funds would come from the actual benefit account. So the way that the program has been set up, we've modeled it after the after Washington, the state of Washington. And so we would be looking at beginning to collect the premiums for the program in January of 2023, and then looking at beginning to pay out benefits January of 2024. And that model has worked very well for the state of Washington, because it sets up the ability to be able to create a self-sustaining program. And what occurred within Washington, they actually had their program go live in the midst of the COVID pandemic, and the program has proven to be sustainable. Premiums are being held at the same level going into 2022 as well. And as we look at sort of the administrative costs to run the program annually between DEED and the Department of Labor, it would be approximately $43 million annually. And the idea, again, is to be able to build a system that would be self-funded, much like the model that is out of Washington.
Representative Jones, I just wanted also to note that the fund that we're giving will be refunded to the general funds by 2023. So essentially, it's a net zero in our budget process. Go ahead.
So this is the intent then is this is going to be self-sustaining. So not only will the account have enough funds to pay for all of the claims, but also $43 million a year in administrative costs. My question is, what happens if it doesn't? Who pays? Where does that money come from if it's not self-sustaining?
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Juergens, for the question. You know, I think that, you know, part of the work that has gone into building the modeling for developing a self-sustaining fund, the department may want to say more about the modeling that has been done for our program, specifically based upon what we know. But we have, again, the ability to look out to many other states who have done this before us. And I think it's really important to recognize that with this setup of having the collection of premiums begin at one point of time and then delaying actually paying out the premiums, we've been able to see in other states that this has been effective. And with the state of Washington, at the time that they began the collection of premiums, they had no idea that, for example, the COVID pandemic was going to strike. They had no idea that they were going to get as many claims as they did, because the number of claims that they anticipated did in fact increase. But because of the delay in terms of the payment of benefits, they have been able to hold together a self sustaining program. And again, they're not in a position of having to increase the premium amounts. And so that is, you know, that is work as we look at the sort of the longevity of this program in future years. We will have to continue to do the work of evaluating the premiums piece.
Representative Juergens, quick.
Yeah, so I guess just real quickly, so if it's not self-sustaining, if it doesn't, I mean, we think it will because we've modeled it after other states and it's worked out in those states, but if it doesn't, you would be looking at increasing the premiums to employers and employees, or we would be looking for a cash infusion from the general fund. It's kind of one or the other. What's our backup plan? That's all I want to know.
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Juergens, for the question. The way that the bill is written, there would be, in fact, evaluation of premiums written into the actual ongoing running of the program.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Richardson. And I too have gotten to see this bill a few times. And one of the things that strikes me is how everybody has a story that relates to either having this and needing wanting other folks to have it, or more likely folks who have family and or constituents who don't have access to this. And I have a story too. My sister, when my dad was dying of cancer in at the Mayo Clinic, my sister and I sat there at a Perkins trying to figure out how she's an ICU nurse, but she wanted to be there for him. And we calculated her PTO and her FMLA and tried to figure out how she could make it work. And I was recently, as we were hearing these bills, talking to her about it, and I asked her, you know, how did you do it? And she took the FMLA, which is unpaid, and she said that my dad helped her out, and that lots of folks, and as we heard from Representative Richardson, don't have that safety net. And I am think that we all sort of on equal payday and everything else need to reflect on how the status quo really isn't working for many of our workers. And so I guess my question for you, Representative Richardson, is when we think about the cost to families and to our economy of our current system, where most folks don't have access to leave, whether it's for pregnancy or whether it's caring for a loved one, what are the costs that we sort of are bearing now with our current system?
Chair Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Greenman, for the question. I mean, we're talking about costs annually and the hundreds of millions of dollars a year. So when people are in a position of where they're either forced to take leave without pay, or they are in a position that they have to quit their job or they're not able to go back to their job. There's also the additional costs that we bear as a state in terms of more reliance on public assistance programs, for example. And there's also the health costs that are faced as well. If we have, for example, a woman doesn't have the ability to take maternity leave. And if she is going into preterm labor, there's costs that are going to be associated with that as well. And so when we think of the number of individuals who had to take, FMLA leave or unpaid leave, it's an upwards of excess of $700 million. Like there's cost to not doing this as well. And again, that cost is disproportionately borne by the people with the biggest challenges to economic security.
Representative Greenwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to, again, appreciate Representative Richardson, you bringing this bill. Critical, I'm proud to support it, critical to provide economic security to all of our workers and families, and particularly those who are most vulnerable. So really appreciate the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Devney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Richardson, thank you for bringing this bill before this committee today. I, too, have seen it in other committees. I want to ask a question of some of the small business folks who testified. And what I'm thinking about is back when my wife and I were in those baby-making years, and our social network was other couples who were also looking to start families or expand their families at that time. And I'll be brief, but I'm a bit of an idiot. And before people, over-apply that, let me be specific. What floored me was the conversations principally amongst the women in the group saying, well, we want to start a family, but my current employer doesn't offer good maternity leave or good health care. And so I've identified another one or two companies in my same industry that are better employers, and I'm going to try to get a job with them, and then we're looking out 2 years before trying to start a family so that I can build up the leave with them that I need. And so my question to the small employers is, what's the impact of employee turnover? What's the disruptive experience of that, of having a valued employee leave? What's the cost to you of the hiring process, the cost to you of training, and so on? Because this has been presented as just a cost to employers, and I'm assuming that there's a benefit in greater stability and employee experience. Can any of them help me with this?
Ms. Harris, I see you're ready to respond to that question.
Well, so childcare is, we're on the spotlight now because we can't, because of the pandemic has highlighted it. But before the pandemic, the shortage, it's starting to affect all of us. When I had an employee, whether working part-time or full-time, I would have to keep my ratios to where I would have to have a second adult caregiver. So if I had something come up, I would either have to give to where that employee no longer could either work for me or that employee was sick. Well, that affected a family because then they had to stay home with their kids because I couldn't be over capacity. So in childcare, it's a little bit different. And obviously when I had my maternity leaves, I had to bring in somebody to play the role of me so that one woman wasn't taking care of 14 children. And that has an effect, again, if people call in sick, especially in childcare, it affects the other families that aren't sick, but now they have to get childcare. It's interesting, childcare, because we have been asked to stay open when the pandemic happened. We've been crazed, which we've been very grateful for. But it has really, there are really no supports, and I don't know how you can recruit people to come into the field to stop the bleeding of childcare providers leaving the field. It's, I mean, it's going to take money, and these upcoming generations, guess what? They want a benefit package. And they're not going to work for themselves if they can go somewhere else that's going to offer healthcare, retirement, and paid medical leave, especially because those people are going to be young and they're going to want families.
Thank you, Ms. Harris. Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Chair Devin.
If we want a state where everyone can thrive, including our business community, it seems like we need to work at it and kind of put our shoulder to the wheel on that. And I think Representative Richardson's bill is an important piece to that. Right now, what we've got is a checkerboard of who gets access to family-sustaining benefits. And they vary across employers if they have them at all. And setting more of a threshold, a floor, for Minnesota families seems to me to be a direction the state should grow to the benefit of everyone, including our economy. So, Representative Richardson, thank you. Mr. Chair, thank you for the time.
Thank you, Chair Devaney. Representative Richardson, your closing remark, make it brief so that we can adjourn for the day. I had so much to comment about this, but I'll save it for another day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will just ask for support.
Thank you so much. I renew my motion, House File 1200, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. So thank you so much, everyone, and to everyone who testified. We've got more work to do, so thank you. With that, we don't have any other item on the agenda. We now adjourn. Thank you.